Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome to Chicago. I think we were just discussing, this is the second time both of us have been here in about a year and a half or so.
Yeah.
It's really cool to see how much of the financial sector is represented here. Like all kinds of fintech startups across the Midwest are here. Yeah. There are insurance companies, banks, and also people who are doing startups and other stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in New York. I'm pretty used to finance, so it's a familiar vibe. I would live here if it was warmer than New York, but here we are.
It was surprisingly warm compared to Vancouver. Vancouver's a little bit cold this time of year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like 70s. It shouldn't be 70s at this time of year, but I'm grateful on a very meta level for it. but yeah, the range of companies, I mean, I think in terms of finance, it kind of tracks with New York. But I'm actually not too familiar with the Chicago tech scene as much anyway.
Yeah, I used to talk a fair bit with the folks from the Google Chicago office when I used to work at Google, but obviously don't work at Google anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's interesting that we now have a number of clients who are here now. So that's kind of exciting.
Okay, cool.
Yes, we should probably actually introduce ourselves because when I say we, like that's not entirely obvious. But yeah, I'm Liz and I work at Honeycomb and
I'm Leslie. Yeah, Leslie and I work at the New York Times as a staff engineer.
And I think one thing that we share in common is that platform engineering is something that's really near and dear to our hearts.
For sure. Yeah, I and SRE as well. Where do you want to go in with that? I know you watched my talk. Yours hasn't happened yet, but I've watched your other talk, so I'm sure.
Yeah, I think let's start with the perennial question. How do you think platform engineering and SRE relate to each other?
So usually how I talk about it is that they're both sort of like applications of DevOps. Mm-hmm. It's like a very simple way of putting it. But yeah, I mean, so like in my talk, I argue that sort of like how SRE emerged from DevOps, like platform engineering emerged from there. So I think like they definitely overlap in terms of just like the practices, like technical practices and the socio-technical sort of approach to it. So, yeah. And then did you ask about differences or did you...
Like, how do they relate to each other? Not necessarily assuming they're different. So I love the thing that you said about like supersets or subsets, because in your talk, you said, hey, like it's not just SRE stuff that's relevant, right? Like there's design system work, right? Like there's other things that help developers do what they want to do with fewer obstacles and helping ensure that they're able to do their jobs more effectively, right? So I think that's a thing where disciplines like reliability and security and UX engineering, right? Like everyone is trying to get developers to do things differently, right? Yeah. Like, and we can either go at it alone and be like, here's your ambassador from SRE, here's your ambassador from UX design, here's your ambassador from accessibility, or we can all come together to make one platform, right?
Yeah.
And say, here are the defaults and come talk to us if you need advice.
Yeah.
And I love that this is finally getting us to, right, like, to collaborate across these disciplines.
Yeah. I mean, that's my favorite part about platform engineering is I view it as like a unifying domain because you can apply like platform and there's like platformization. I don't know if you've heard that like term, but you can apply it.
No, I haven't.
So platformization of your technology. So I think that idea can apply like across so many, many use cases. And I think I find that like sort of unifying thing super appealing because I think tech could use some unification in more intentional ways.
The reason why I think we're seeing all of these platform teams emerging is people have realized that creating the job title DevOps engineer does not work, that trying to adopt SRE the way that Google originally espoused it is not working for them.
Right.
Like, so they're kind of grasping at this concept of how do we ensure developer productivity, engineers are more and more scarce, how do we make sure that we are not just throwing more and more and more duplicative engineers at a problem, but right. like how are we actually investing in engineering and kind of empowering them to do more?
Yeah.
So, but I think, again, like similar to SRE, that's going to be doomed to fail unless people are following some degree of common practices and learning from each other. And I think that's really what was great was you kind of laid out some of those, right, like some of those areas ranging from the principles to the implementation, right? Like I thought that was a good approach. And I think it was resonating with the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I love the SRE. I mean, SRE was my entry point to platform engineering. So it's always going to be near and dear to my heart. But actually recently I saw, you know, Alex Hidalgo.
Hidalgo, yes. Yeah.
He posted about how the SRE book, like even that, like not even everything that went into the SRE book was actually like validated in the ways that people kind of assume everything was. And I thought that was super interesting because like no one's willing to admit that. Like sometimes there's a little bit of like theory in there, which is why I like the conversations like this where we get to talk about more nitty gritty.
Yeah, right. Like, and with nuance, as opposed to Alex wound up deleting that conversation because it was getting quoted out of context and people were like demanding retractions of the book. And it's like, no, right. Like, it was actually practiced by one team at Google. That's like, you know, a lab experiment that works in mice. So if you go and take that lab experiment that works in mice and you're like, that didn't work in humans, you should retract your paper. It's like, no, this is suggesting avenues for further research.
Exactly.
This is not.
Yeah. And I think that's the one thing I really love about SRE is that it emphasizes experimentation so much. And like, when I read the SRE book from Google, I didn't take it as a like, oh, manual, step-by-step manual. But I think it's a great conversation starter, which is why I like talks and watching talks and whatnot. And I hope that's what my talk did that in terms of starting conversations.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that worked because you were like, here's some examples of how we applied it, but like here, but also here's the overarching principle that we think holds true. Let me know what you think, right?
Yeah.
Try it out and see what happens. But I think one of the challenges is that does take having psychological safety, that does take having people being willing to take risks and fail.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, you're not necessarily going to succeed as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I have a whole separate talk on psychological safety. I actually like that one more, but I think because it's more softer, I don't think it's as popular, but I like it more.
At the end of the day, everything we do is made up of the people in the systems.
I mean,
whether you use the word socio-technical, whether you use the word that my colleague Jessitron uses, somatheci, right? Like systems of learning parts, right? Like either way, it's that our systems are dynamic and we need to treat people as part of the system design.
Yeah, totally agreed. Yeah, you're where I really started to dive into the socio-technical thinking. Like that's funny. You were my entry point to SRE too, actually. I totally forgot about that. But yeah, and you're part of why I started doing talks, actually.
Well, this is really exciting because you give really great talks.
Oh, thank you. Which maybe that's actually the entryway towards where you started asking me about you know, being a woman of color and whatnot, which like I guess is to say, I'm what happens when you have women of color to actually look up to. So if that
I like you kind of have to have that existence proof of I can do it because that other person like did it and is surviving. But also I thought that was really interesting, the thing you said about the presumption of, oh, Leslie must be a front-end engineer. It turns out front-end engineering is really complicated and difficult. And like, I look in awe at our front-end engineers, right? Like,
I agree.
It's like, wait, you don't have hard and fast requirements about how the system runs? Like, it's subjective and in the view of the user, whether it worked or not? Wow.
Yeah.
Like, there's no acceptance test for this. This is fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I feel about it. Yeah, I always joke that I'm like, it's just too complicated for me. I think like backend is a lot more straightforward. And I know people will argue like the opposite, of course. But I don't know. I definitely have like an appreciation for the craftsmanship that goes into it.
There's this joke that we had when I was going to college because I went to a science focused college and kind of there was this hierarchy of the mathematicians were like, we're the purest. And, you know, those physicists are out there are doing applied mathematics and the physicists are like the chemists are doing applied physics. And it's just like, right. And that goes all the way down to biology and psychology and so forth. And it's like, no, we could argue about whose discipline is pure or we could work together and collaborate to achieve results.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, exactly. For sure. I've seen that trend, I think, in every aspect of my career, even college, just the, like, sort of there can be like an elitism, I guess, assigned to different types of domains and whatnot. And like a lot of it does have to do with like how hard of a science is and whatnot. I was in a school of engineering, so computer science was seen as like the soft one, which is kind of funny to say out loud. But even within CS though, right, like there was the people who were more on the systems. They were literally like systems track versus like application track, which is more front end and whatnot.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I don't know how much this has changed over the past 10 years, but definitely when I was going to college, there was very much of a lack of teaching of what it's like to actually run production systems. Like you would get assigned a class course and you would turn in your assignment for the week, or maybe you'd have a project for a month. And then you knew you would drop that project after that month and you would never think about it again.
Exactly.
And that's not how modern software development works. Right? Like we need to use source control and we need to have comments and tests, because otherwise the person who comes after you, even if you drop the project after a month, someone else has to pick it up after a month.
Yep.
Like,
Agreed. I wish there was not as much room to... I feel like school was good at teaching me how to write new code, but not how to contribute to like existing code bases at all.
Right. Like that other element of how do you familiarize yourself in a brownfield project?
Yeah. I wish we had more of that, because I think that would have come in handy so much more. Because especially if you're, I mean, I've worked at like non-startups for pretty much my entire career. So I was like rarely writing things completely from scratch. So like I was having to learn systems first before actually being able to contribute it. But I, again, like just did not feel equipped going into that for sure.
Yeah, it's really cool. A former Googlestory named Mikey Dickerson has created this college course on creating and running reliable systems, which is really cool, where he's like, you know, hey, here's a simple service. Your first week's task is to just get the service up and running and printing hello. And now make it print hello when it's hit with a million queries per second by the end of the semester. And it's like, and also when I take down an availability zone, and also when, right, like I mess with your database, right? Like, and I think that that's something that needs to be duplicated more, so that there are kind of more entry points into this discipline of platform engineering, so people can come in feeling like, okay, I know what this kind of work is about, I know that I enjoy it, and I feel prepared to do it.
Yeah. Ooh, actually, since you are so big in open source, also, like, I thought about this problem with respect to how do we train, like, students to become open source developers, too. I did actually work on this at, like, in college, but it was so hard. So I'm curious, like, if you've what your thoughts are around that. But I just saw today someone posted, I remembered who it was, but it's an O'Reilly course that's on how to become an open source contributor. And I didn't get to look into it because then I ran here, but the idea was super appealing. And I know that you're huge in the open telemetry space, so.
One of the things about open source is that it has these cultural norms. And those cultural norms are being rewritten over time. So you can definitely, you know, a course on how to contribute to open source 20 years ago might have been, here's how to suck up to Linus Torvalds, right? Like, and get him to not yell at you, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
I'd like to hope that we've moved past this era, mostly, of the lead maintainer will yell at you if he, and by and large it was he, doesn't like your patch.
Yes.
But now we're having all of these interesting distortions around corporate open source, right? Like, what does it mean when you have the lead contributors to a project all having the same employer and then being able to relicense at will, right? Like, we've seen kind of the breakdown, right? Like, the continued breakdown of the non-foundation model with the WordPress fiasco going on as we record this. But I think, by and large, the things that historically, in my experience, have held true with open source contribution is people need to appreciate what it's like to be an open source maintainer in order to, you know, just to function in our modern world, because you will inevitably be using someone else's open source code base, even if you are not an open source maintainer yourself. It behooves you to get some experience with what that's like so that you write better bug reports, right? So that you are kinder to the people who are those open source maintainers, and that's so that we can kind of create that culture where we don't have open source maintainer burnout.
How do you see any, well, maybe let's just talk through the idea of what would it look like to build that sort of industry where we have that?
Well, I used to be employed by Google from 2008 to 2019, right? So in that time, I watched Google do the Google Summer of Code, right? Like, and have software developers who are in computer science degrees in their sophomore, junior years of college, and they would, Google would pay them $3,000 or something to work for a summer on an open source project.
Yes,
right? And it wasn't just Google, right? Mm-hmm. It was other companies, but Google was facilitating it. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a partial start, right? Like that kind of gets people exposure to doing open source work for pay. Mm-hmm. But I think some of that is working on feature requests, mm-hmm. right? There's very much this long tail, though, of software is out there and then you have to maintain it, especially in a world where there are security patches, right? Like we live in a very, it's the security engineering equivalent of litigious, right? Like instead of, you know, you get sued all the time, but you get bug bounties opened against you all the time, yep. being like, you know, this particular sub package is vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. Like, right, how do we push out fixes across the whole open source ecosystem, right? Like, so I don't entirely know how we kind of reconcile this. You know, you can get people in to work at entry level on adding more surface area to attack, as opposed to getting people to maintain when they're not necessarily very trusted, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's the problem is, you know, a university student writes the code, so what? Mm-hmm. Someone has to review it and merge it, right? Yep. And then carry the feeding of it forever, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's that. And also I was talking to some of the OpenSSL maintainers about 6 months ago or so. Almost a year ago. So I was talking to some of the OpenSSL maintainers, and one of the interesting things they pointed out is the people on the OpenSSL maintainership team, many of them don't have any kind of professional experience as software developers, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's people who are cryptography nerds who just started hacking in C, mm-hmm. right? And yeah, so I think we have to figure out what does it look like to have sustainable models where companies that benefit from open source actually fund people to work on it and also avoid the vendor lock-in and also avoid the kind of relicensing and forking drama.
Yep, yep.
Because honestly, that's what turns people off of open source a lot, right, is having to deal with drama.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, it, very true.
Drama and certain funding. Like, can you see why people might not want to pursue that as a career?
Yeah. I mean, I open source is something I feel like I've always sort of been adjacent to in terms of wanting to be a contributor. But yeah, I think it's hard. It was easier to even actually explore it in college, I think, because most companies don't invest in open source in the ways that they do. So I found it actually easier, like when I had no work obligations.
Right, exactly. And also no one breathing down your neck being like, you know, is your contribution approved for relicensing under the contributor license agreement? Right. When you're a college student, you don't have to worry about that.
Exactly.
Yeah. But like all this stuff underpins the work of every platform engineer, right? Yep. Like we all, by and large, have to maintain Kubernetes platforms. Mm-hmm. And I think this also is a favorite pet peeve of mine. People keep conflating Kubernetes with being a developer platform. Kubernetes is not a developer platform.
Yes,
Kubernetes is a platform for building a developer platform. It's so meta, right?
Yes.
We cannot expect every software developer to have to learn how to write Kubernetes manifests.
Yeah, oh, absolutely not. Yes, as much as that would be enticing, I'm sure, for everyone who's a developer.
And that also creates this conundrum of, okay, so you've got the population of software developers out there. Mm-hmm. You've got the population of platform engineers who are using Kubernetes to build a platform for those software developers. And then we've got the set of Kubernetes contributors who are then providing the components that are used by platform engineers, right? Like it's so many layers of abstraction away from the actual end user problem.
Yep.
That it leads both to people not understanding that this requires care and feeding, and also to us potentially building the wrong solutions. Mm-hmm. It leads to, you know, people not being funded to work on the actual problems. So I think the more people can kind of rotate onto, at least, right, like, you know, I have a thing that I'd like to fix, like, you know, I'm going to contribute upstream, or like I'm going to write a useful bug report, right? Mm-hmm. Like, these are things that we need to get practice with in order to make sure that we are contributing upstream. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms, you asked me about OTEL, and I think the answer to how OTEL has navigated some of these things mm-hmm. is because OpenTelemetry has such strong incentives around observability and telemetry generation, they kind of need to be grounded in commonality of data. Mm-hmm. It means that by and large, with one exception, but even in that case, it's changing. By and large, the major players in the observability vendor space want to deduplicate effort. They don't want to have, you know, Splunk SDK and mm-hmm. Sentry SDK and right. Honeycomb SDK, right? Like, we just want to have one SDK. Mm-hmm. And library authors are aligned here because they want to build in a telemetry library as opposed to having to make it something that you're hot swapping in at runtime or having it be something where they have to play favorites.
Yep.
Right. So I think everyone is aligned there from vendors, end users, library authors. I think everyone wants that project to succeed. Mm. So I think that's how we've managed to get the funding for our efforts is because people already were investing development effort into developing SDKs. Mm-hmm. So this was just a let's pull our resources together.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's like, that's the beauty of centralization of efforts and whatnot, which happens like, I think platform engineering, we talk about it, you know, usually in the context, IDPs, I think are, we use those interchangeably too, which like internal developer platform.
Yes, I was about to ask you to spell it out because not all of the people who are listening to this are going to be familiar with our terminology.
Yes. But yeah, so we also conflate, a lot of times I see platform engineering being conflated with just the development of IDPs, which I think is another problem as well.
Yes, exactly. And I love that you were like writing documentation as a form of platform engineering, right? Yeah. Like it doesn't have to be, you know, you have a backstage plugin for it.
Yeah. I think the most powerful thing, one of my favorite things about like our pipelines at the times is that I have the docs automatically generated based off of comments and things like that because I don't have to worry about it. And like documentation is so important, but keeping up documentation up to date is annoying sometimes, right? But that's why I think it's all the more important that we find these kind of ways.
Yeah. And the challenge with documentation is that misleading documentation is worse than no documentation. At least if there's no documentation, you know, here be dragons.
Yes.
But if the documentation leads you astray, like you've now invested a bunch of time in developing the wrong mental model.
Yes. Right?
Like, because this is the thing that I keep on saying about like the goal of observability, right? The goal of observability is to give you and your systems a feedback loop so that you have a good mental model of what the system is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So if you develop the wrong mental model, I actually had an outage like that a couple of weeks ago where I misled myself into believing that the system was in a different state than it was. Mm. And therefore I disregarded feedback that was showing me that the system was in fact in a different broken state than I thought it was, right? Mm-hmm. Like red herrings and human biases are so real.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think having data that can help you challenge your assumptions is just super crucial. That's also what I like about observability is the sort of what I said about unifying domain. It's such a like full stack problem, genuinely. A lot of my talks in platform engineering come from an observability perspective because of that. I don't know if you found that to be helpful for having conversations.
Yeah, definitely, right? Like, it's the source of the data, by and large.
Exactly.
You can write all the design documents in the world, but if your design document says service A does not call service B and you have a trace saying that service A does call service B, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's... Which one are you going to believe?
Yes. At an old team, when I was actually onboard, being like a manager onboarding people onto teams and whatnot, I used to tell like my reports or whatnot that I just go into like our observability vendor and see what API like endpoints come up for any given service or whatnot. And that was the easiest way to actually figure out what's going on with our systems. Like just digging through the code base or like docs was far less effective in terms of getting the right mental model.
Yeah, although there's kind of that challenge there that we need to figure out, which is helping people navigate from trace span names or API endpoint names to the relevant lines of code, which is easier in some languages than others, depending upon kind of the stack trace generation or mm-hmm. the metaprogramming constructs, right? To say this trace comes from this line of code at this commit.
Yeah, I also found it helpful for them finding confusing points. Like if something that appears in the telemetry is not what they would have expected, like being able to flag that. I mean, just the beginner kind of, I think, look was super helpful. yeah, I don't know if you've experimented with doing anything like that during onboarding and whatnot, or how
onboarding is super interesting in that we try, this has gotten harder to scale as we've gotten larger, but usually the most recent batch of people who are recruited, the second most recent batch of people who are recruited to our engineering organization, mm-hmm. does the platform architecture overview for the newest set of recruits. It's okay. Really fun.
Oh, that's cool.
Because it means that we kind of have this living, right, like, right. You know, oral story about, like, you know, or legend of, like, you know, how the system came to be and how it works. And of course, there are more senior engineers who sit in on it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how we avoid having that central dependence upon that one most tenured person, is mm-hmm. that this is actually a epic or a story being told by the newest people.
Yes. Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, I love that.
You mentioned you were a manager before, so let's talk about the engineer manager pendulum.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where do you want to begin? Right now I'm not an engineering manager. I can talk about why I'm not an engineering manager right now, but how about you?
So I'm technically the field, right? Like, it's one of those weird things where I'm the field CTO at Honeycomb. I have no direct reports, and also Charity has no direct reports aside from me, right? Mm-hmm, like, so mm-hmm. we're the co-CTOs, and we are in a department off on our own. So, like, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Working on the kind of executive level business problems, but mm-hmm. not necessarily the people management parts. But also, I've been a SRE manager before. I used mm-hmm. to manage, while I was living in New York, I used to manage the Cloud Bigtable SRE team. And then I went back to being an individual contributor working on SRE education and working with Google Cloud's customers. So yeah, I've been back and forth on that manager and engineer pendulum myself. Mm-hmm. So
how do you make a decision on when to switch sort of back and forth? How much of it is just, like, very personal versus strategic?
I think it's based partly on what are the organization's needs, mm-hmm. what are my own needs, yep. what's going to further my career development the best right now, and also deliver the most impact. So that's kind of how I've thought about it. But definitely that experience of being a manager has been super, super helpful, right, in understanding organizational psychology. Why do organizations make decisions the way they do?
Yep. Yes.
Right? Or how do we help and facilitate people on our team that we're the tech lead of mm-hmm. in their career development and growth,
yeah.
right? How do we work with a manager to help someone who's maybe on a performance plan, right? Mm-hmm. Like, having an experience of having been the manager in that situation really, really is helpful for kind of, you know, not being, like, completely mystified, like, you know, why did they do that, right? Like, they is a group of managers,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think I found it super helpful and, I don't know how much I should be talking about what's going on at my company with respect to the labor union dispute, but that actually has been really helpful in the union negotiations we've been doing the last couple years, because
yeah,
I've sort of been, I guess, on both sides, but yeah. I mean, there's a lot of nuance there too.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly when we were doing organizing at Google, kind of there's a spectrum of, okay, do we actually believe that line managers, right, like people who are, you know, mid-career managers, do we believe that they have sufficient influence over company policy to, you know, be part of capital M management as yes. far as, like, right, like that's kind of an interesting discussion that's happening in our industry, right? Like, and under labor law, right, like, it boils down to, does that person have the power to actually fire someone? Mm-hmm. And in many yep. cases, the answer is no, right? Like, they yeah. have to get the sign off of HR and their director. Yep. And, like, you know, it's like, okay, like, you know, these people are kind of executing the will of the organization in some ways, but not necessarily, you know, setting strategy or, right? Like, mm-hmm. so I think, yeah, it's super interesting, right? Like, you know, certainly I'm not going to make you talk about what's going on at your employer, but, like, I have seen this play out definitely as far as, you know, what is our role in shaping effective organizations, whether it be from an individual contributor or manager perspective?
Yeah. My situation is super complicated, but I know, I guess, especially because you're in the, like, a field CTO position. How does that feel like in terms of, you know, more, it being more of a feeling like a manager role versus like IC role or some weird in between? As I know that's—
Yeah, it's definitely a weird in between.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I do not have to do performance management of reports. But I do, you know, think about budgets. Mm-hmm. I do think about strategy. And the field part specifically is, you know, Cherry and I both are very frequent conference speakers. But Charity spends the time that she's not speaking at conferences looking after kind of the internal organization structure, the, you know, our board, our executive team, company strategy, whereas I'm a lot more focused on working one-on-one with our clients and helping our clients execute their strategies.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of where that delineation of field versus home comes from.
Cool, interesting.
But, you know, either way, both of us are looking very much at which direction is the industry heading and how do we help the company succeed in that circumstance. So do I write code? Sometimes. Do I cause incidents? Sometimes. right, like you're not going to take that away from me simply because it's part of how I continue to be someone that you ought to listen to, because, you know, the instant that I retire from writing code, that's going to be the instant that I stop being relevant.
Yeah. Yes. 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 And that's the hard part of being a manager, is like that idea of staying relevant, I guess.
But I never do anything that's in the critical path of delivery, right? Yes. Like that's super important, right? Like I think that's common to most managers, right? Yep. Like you do not want to be working on something that is, you know, where you have to pick between I'm going to deal with a performance management issue on my team or I'm going to write code. Like you have to look after the team first, right? Like always.
Yep.
But if it's things that are in service of the team, right, a thing that I worked on a couple of weeks ago and posted about on LinkedIn was I was looking at our build times and I was noticing that our build times were getting slower and slower, that they regressed from 10 minutes to 12 minutes to 14 minutes. And I said, enough is enough. Like, I've got 2 days spare. I'm going to just look at it. And I cut it to 10 minutes and then I cut it to 6.5 minutes, right? Like, and that's a thing that no one had put on the roadmap. It was not blocking any team, but it was a thing that I could do to just get out of the way of, you know, help the team execute faster.
Yep. Someone asked me about how do I go about prioritizing that kind of work. And I had my answer, but I'm curious what yours is.
Yeah, let's compare our answers. Yeah. So my answer to how you prioritize kind of maintenance and care and feeding work is, it's very similar to how we think in SRE about paying down toil, right? That a majority of your team's time should be spent not doing toil. So to people who are not familiar with the SRE space, we define toil as repetitive, automatable work that doesn't require human judgment necessarily. So, but obviously the non-toil work can also then be bucketed into, is this feature work or is this platform work,
right?
So I think as a platform team, that decision is, that priority is almost set by the organization of how much effort are they get, how many resources are they giving to platform versus to product. But if you are a little bit more monolithic of an organization and you're making decisions on how to prioritize platform versus product work on your own team, I think that's going to depend a lot on the stage that your organization is at. I feel like I'm repeating the talk on decision dials from the keynote yesterday, right? Like, it depends on the state of your organization, because sometimes you're going to have to incur more technical debt in order to make it to market, to raise revenue. But there will come a time where if you're not careful about paying down that debt, paying down the principal, right? Like the interest is going to overcome everything else. And you're going to spend way too much time doing toil.
Yes. I mean, I think I emphasize that I just, like, I try to rely on having as much evidence at any given time so that I can figure out when's the right time to reprioritize. Because I think, like, initial prioritization, you know, it's absolutely should do, you know, a thorough job of, like, figuring out the priority. But you also have to just acknowledge that priorities are going to change and kind of rely a little bit on that.
Yes, I love that, right? Like, gathering evidence to know when you should change your priorities. Yeah. So our SRE team does this in that they survey our our SRE and platform teams survey our developers who are working not on platform.
Yep.
And they ask questions like, how did your last on-call shift feel? Text field, not, you know, not 1 to 5, but how did your last on-call shift feel, right? Or how easy was it to add UI components, right? Like, and based off of that, that helps us inform where we prioritize our time as a platform team. That helps us figure out, okay, are we under or over investing in certain areas, right? Like when is enough polish there? And ideally we get ahead of problems. Like, for instance, you know, we're now in a slightly better state than we were before as far as, okay, we have time and energy to work on rewriting our deployment system.
Yep.
right? We know that we're hiring more developers. We know that we now are regularly in a state where the hourly push train has four or more changes rather than only 1 to 3. Mm-hmm. That's a state where, you know, before we get to 6 changes going out in a single release, like, we need to make sure that we're more incrementally deploying. That requires us to do a progressive train, continuous train, rather than hourly, right? Mm-hmm. How do we get the tooling in a state, right? Like, so, I think there's kind of this, you know, initially you have to do what you have to do to get the job done.
Right.
And then later you can kind of set the roadmap and say, if we continue to grow, these are problems we're going to be facing. Let's make sure that we're proactive about addressing them.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, the way I think about it is, well, in my psychological safety talk, I talk about the idea of like 3 sort of phases, like reactive phase versus like proactive versus yep. preventative. So as you were saying that, that kind of like oscillated on it. Because I think when you're in a more reactive state, what prioritization looks like is extremely different than when you're in a more like proactive, preventative sort of state as a team. Oversimplification, but.
And I guess the addendum to that thing about build times is, so I did that because I got annoyed. But it turns out that was on the SRE team's OKRs for last quarter, but it had fallen off the bottom of their priority list.
There you go.
Right, because more urgent things came up. And of course, you don't want me in the critical path of doing something urgent.
Yes. Yep.
But it was important work, and mm-hmm. it was work that I was able to get off of that team's roadmap because, mm-hmm. you know, by doing it.
Yes. So. Yeah, those are my favorite developers, when they do the work for you without even trying.
It's also, I mean, like, as someone who is not reporting to our VP of engineering, right, like, yep. I think it's important for me to, sure, I will turn up, I turn up occasionally with harebrained ideas, and mm-hmm. sometimes it distracts people or causes work or churn.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like I owe it to the team to also chop wood and carry water,
yep.
right? Like,
yep.
that if mm-hmm. I don't do that, I'm going to have a very resentful team that's like, exactly. Liz is turning up again with another thing that's disrupting
exactly.
us. As opposed to, you know, hey, Liz, like, you know, both contributes to experiments and also cleans up after mm-hmm. her experiments, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's a great way. I mean, it's a way of making sure you have your trust with the people you work with at the end of the day. No one likes being told what to do without.
And yeah. I think that applies to platform teams too, right? That
yes.
platform teams need to provide value to the organizations, right? We cannot just say we have a monopoly on the platform. You exactly. work here, you have to use us.
Exactly. Yes, yes. That's why I said the point about it's not our job as platform engineers to tell other people what to do. It's our job to like help them do what they need to do. Because I think for platform engineers, I do see sometimes like that tendency to be very like, do what we say because we're the centralized platform team, which is.
And that's how you get shadow IT.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes, shadow ops. Very familiar with that concept, unfortunately.
Hopefully not from your current workplace.
I mean, I think every workplace has some shadow ops, especially if they're an older company. Yeah, it's hard for me to. I mean, I have maybe it does exist out there, but I haven't seen a company that's large and doesn't have any shadow ops, really.
Yeah, but you know, either you can develop a platform that gets people excited about migrating to it, so that they
yes.
don't have to do shadow ops anymore,
agreed.
Right? Like, that's how you get people to complain about it. It's mm-hmm. not by, you know, we're going to root out, you know, and
exactly.
look at everyone's credit card expenses to
yep.
find out who's spending money. Like,
mm-hmm. yep.
Well, this was super exciting and fun. I really enjoyed this conversation
yeah.
about platform engineering and everything that comes along with it.
Yes,
agreed. Platform engineering, open source, and how we get people into our field.
Yes, agreed. Thank you for speaking with me. This was awesome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.